TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Patrick Michaels, taking the reins this week from Jonathan McNamara while he takes what I'm sure is a much-needed vacation. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. Today, we're joined by the Observer's associate editor, Forrest Wilder.
Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Forrest. And Austin-based journalist and activist, Jessica Luther.
Hi.
Hi. Later in the show, we'll also be joined by the Observer's politics writer, Chris Hooks, who's in Dallas, anticipating the state Democratic convention. And we'll talk about the political messaging around the growing humanitarian crisis on the Texas-Mexico border, including what it means to use that word crisis I just used. But first, this was the one-year anniversary of now gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis's historic filibuster and an unruly mob's historic gathering at the state capitol to block a slate of strict new restrictions on abortion access. The governor called for another special session, and the bill passed anyway, and much of it took effect last fall. So while it's still legal to get an abortion in Texas, you can now only do so in El Paso, Austin, San Antonio, Houston, or Dallas-Fort Worth. Clinics in at least 10 other cities between those big six have closed since the law took effect. So what's the legacy of last summer's long nights at the Capitol? The Observer named Jessica Luther one of our monthly tyrant's foes last year for her role rallying the Orange Army, work that began before the effort was synonymous with Wendy Davis and well before Davis was running for governor. So on this filibusterversary, how well has that crowd at the Capitol translated into a lasting movement? Or, Jessica, is that even a fair question to ask now about last summer's movement at all?
I think that's the question that's really to be asking at this point. There was so much media around it, but also just so much work that went into what happened last summer. You know, it was 7 weeks at the Capitol in total to the point where HB 2 passed. But like you said, there were months before, which I wasn't even involved in, but starting at the beginning of the legislative session, there was meetings after meetings with the coalition of organizations.
And it seems like pretty early on, there was the idea that we have all these people who weren't involved in the process very much before. How do you keep that movement going, you know, on in the months after that?
Yeah, and I think that's been a struggle, honestly. A lot of people, I think, thought that the Davis campaign would be sort of stepping in and taking that momentum, and we've seen how that's been an up and down. So as someone who's just sort of on the outside, I'm not part of an organization, I get a lot of people who contact me and they just want something to do. And that's still true like a year later. People will contact me and they want to know more about something that's going on, and they want to know if I have information on it because they still want to be involved. And so for me, that's a really good sign. It is a little frustrating that we're a year out and there's still people trying to figure out where they need to be and how to do it. But the fact that people, like you said, that like never before, I often say, I know a lot of people who were like radicalized by last summer, who are now both deeply involved in political campaigns, or they've started their own organizations to react to HB2, or like I said, they're just still trying to figure out where they can fit in and how they can help and what they can do.
So there are a lot of people who maybe started their own groups or gone and joined some existing groups. There wasn't like an official Orange Army group that formed because of what happened and
off
and doing things.
No, yeah. There's actually a bunch. There's been a lot of different groups, and that's been a really good thing, I think, rather than one just kind of organization. So we've seen, for example, a really good example would be Fund Texas Women, which a 20-year-old Austin woman put together immediately in the wake of HB 2 passing last summer, because it was clear that there were going to be clinics that were going to close, that there were going to be a lot of people who weren't going to have access to the care that they needed, and they were literally going to need bus tickets, and they were going to need hotel rooms paid for. And so she just, like overnight, decided to start an organization that she says in the first 6 months they have raised and given out $17,000 to over 50 people to help them access abortion care. So that's just one example of there are multiple groups like Whole Women's Health has Texans, their Texas Action Fund, which does really similar work. The Bridge Collective has a thing they called Stand, which is the same sort of transportation, logistical stuff. There's groups in the Rio Grande Valley that have come together to do the same kind of work, because that's a specific case where they really have to they have a long way to go if they're going to actually access care. And so that's sort of a band-aid on a really big bleeding wound that's happened, but we see it in a lot of different spaces in the state right now, people trying to just get people where they need to go, and that's a direct result of HB2.
As far as people transitioning from the grassroots activism that we saw at the Capitol into the Wendy Davis campaign, mm-hmm. and I don't mean political professionals, I mean just ordinary folks, what have you seen there? Has there been a lot of that? And what's your perception of how the Davis campaign has picked up that banner on women's health issues and abortion?
I mean, sort of famously, they won't say the word abortion. They almost never. It's all couched right now and very much like women's health care. But there was even a fundraising email that went out yesterday that didn't have the word women in it. So they have a very sort of, I think it's pretty obvious that they know that they should be doing something about the fact that it was a really big deal last year, but they're so cagey around whether or not they want her to be the candidate that has something to do with abortion. I have personally talked with people in Davis campaign. They have reached out to me and asked me for, you know, my opinions on how things are going. So they definitely reach out on a personal level. And I know that that's true for other people as well. Mm-hmm. But what that looks like translated on the larger scale, I think that's been pretty obvious as far as the only time she says abortion or the campaign. I've heard her actually say abortion in smaller settings, but the campaign says abortion only with the abortion Barbie as a response to that entire.
So they're kind of playing off some of the extreme rhetoric of the other side.
Right.
Rather than saying we stand for abortion rights.
Right.
Directly. I thought it was interesting now that we're kind of in the season of the 1 year anniversary of the filibuster and just the whole showdown at the Capitol. There's some of the emails coming from Wendy Davis and some of the appearances she's made. The focus has been on recalling the filibuster as taking on, quote, Austin insiders.
Yeah.
End quote.
Yeah.
You didn't hear a whole lot about Austin insiders at the Capitol, say. Not
yeah,
at all much.
I don't know what that is. And I'm not really sure what they mean by that.
You're not shaking your fist every morning when you get up at the Austin insiders?
No, I don't really. That's not actually the location in Texas that I would think of as being the problem with this issue.
If you're a state senator, you might be an Austin insider.
To name one, yeah. Or maybe the state senator's campaign officials.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's curious.
I guess the larger question is, just leaving aside whether that's good, you know, from an ethical perspective or whatever, but mm-hmm. politically, does that make sense? Because I think I understand why they're doing it. They don't want to, it's a divisive issue, and it's better to stay away from something that's going to turn off some people that you might hope would vote for you. But the downside to that, just speaking strategically, is that it dampens enthusiasm among your base.
Mm-hmm.
What's your perception on that? Are people, folks who got energized or radicalized at the Capitol, are they saying, hey, this isn't what we signed up for? Or is it more like, we understand, we wish you would speak more, but we still love Wendy Davis?
I think it's more the latter. I definitely talk to people who fall in that first camp. And there are days where I fall into that first camp for sure. But I do think, it's hard because I don't know how to run a political campaign. So on some level, I understand that if I'm critiquing that who am I to be the one? At the same time, the Texas Democrats haven't really run a successful campaign in a couple decades either, right? So who is it that gets to say sort of what's going to be effective? And at this point, there are people in that base who feel like we're still here. And I mean, I really like Senator Davis when I see her on her own, when she's off the cuff, when she's just talking. It's still really powerful. She's really good at that. The sort of scripted campaign version of Davis is, I think people feel like, okay, we understand what's going on, but that's definitely not the person that we all witnessed last summer. And that is something that's been repeated to me.
I had one other question for you about sort of the impact of the law, and now that a lot of these clinics have closed, and all the clinics in the Valley, for instance.
Yeah.
And a lot of these were places where, you know, if you're not in a city, the clinic might be the place where you hear about sort of what's going on in reproductive rights news or what the latest is with the law. And so, you know, you had a whole influx of people who got really fired up about this issue last summer. Mm-hmm. But then once the law took effect, a lot of the places where you might have had little, like, satellite gatherings of folks who are interested are suddenly gone. I mean, where is there in the Valley or in, Midland, Odessa, Lubbock, places like that for someone who's, wanting to talk about this stuff or try and educate people about it? Is there any other kind of option in places like that?
Well, there's definitely universities. So we see a lot of, I know like Texas Tech has a really vocal feminist group that does work around this. And I know that Andrea Grimes has done reporting on East Texas, and she specifically talked about college kids in East Texas, like starting, you know, they're very new feminist groups, and these are the things that they're rallying around because, Beaumont lost its clinic. And so in the Valley, the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health has done a lot of work there. And so they've really helped create this Texas Latina advocacy group. And they are this amazing group of women who live and work there, who are doing a lot of work to get knowledge out, to let people know both sort of what's going on and how they can get access if they need it, if they can, right? There are just people who literally can't get access anymore because of borders and all sorts of things. So I think that, I mean, it's a really good question. Texas is hard because it's so big, and we're here in Austin, and we're sort of sheltered, as an activist. I'm totally aware of that. So what's really going on? But I know that there are places, I mean, there are people reporting on this, like Andrea, or Al Jazeera has gone to the Valley and found these activists and stuff. So it's definitely still happening. But you're totally right that clinics were really important places where people would go if they had any kind of crisis around reproductive health, right? So like Jane's Due Process, which is this a group that it's the only one in the country that helps minors that get pregnant if they need legal help, they're having a big problem now that if you're a teenager in crisis and you're pregnant, the first place you would go is probably to an abortion clinic to figure out like what you can do. And so they've seen huge drop-offs, like teens aren't calling anymore, right? And in certain areas of the state because they just don't have those reference points that they used to. So the clinics were really important, and that's true. There are people working right now to try to do something about that, but it is like they do have to find new places where they can do that.
All right. Well, Jessica, thanks for being with us. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour conversation with folks at the Texas Observer. In our second half of the show, we're going to be talking about the escalating crisis on the Texas-Mexico border. Hoping to escape violence in Central America, families and even children sent traveling alone have been arriving in South Texas hoping for asylum in the United States. Federal courts and detention facilities in Texas have been overwhelmed. Observer writer Melissa Del Bosque has been reporting on this issue for a while now. But the growing humanitarian crisis is just now starting to get politicians' attention. And so far, there's not much of a sign that that's a very good thing for everybody else. Forrest Wilder just wrote about some of the most popular proposals from Texas officials and why they're all such terrible ideas. Tell us what's been proposed so far and whether you think Texas officials really even have a role to play in this problem.
Well, I don't know if they're all terrible. I just focused on the terrible ones. But generally, yeah, not great. I mean, I think everybody acknowledges that this is a huge humanitarian crisis. I mean, it's pretty hard to see images of thousands of kids that have made a very, very difficult journey at great personal risk by themselves in many cases, and then coming to a foreign country and finding out that they're not actually, maybe even going to be able to stay. So this is something that, you certainly, I think most people can agree is kind of a heartbreaking situation. But of course, then the next question is, what do you do? And that's where things get very tricky. Governor Perry, Rick Perry, has probably been the most prominent voice in Texas, basically calling on the Obama administration to take action, as well as saying the state of Texas is going to step up and do certain things. One of the things that I thought was most interesting and problematic in Perry's kind of suite of proposals was he published an op-ed after touring a detention facility in McAllen earlier this week, and basically described the kind of scene there with, you know, children kind of in this state of shock and crying, and he, obviously it was moving to him. And in the course of his op-ed, he basically says, well, what we need to do is we need to make sure that people back in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador understand that when they come here, they're going to be immediately deported back to their home countries.
Which you can do that?
No, you cannot. I mean, that's the first problem with this. That does not happen and cannot happen because there are treaty obligations that the United States is subject to when it comes to asylum seekers.
Even
and refugees.
Texas.
Even the sovereign state of Texas, even with the, considering the 10th Amendment,
okay.
Yes, is bound by these treaties and federal law, statutes. There's actually special accommodations made for unaccompanied minors. Why? Because they're so vulnerable. Many of them are victims of crimes, human trafficking, violent acts that are committed. The United Nations Refugee Commissioner has estimated that unaccompanied minors crossing the border into the United States, some 58% of them qualify for special consideration under international law. In other words, they are bona fide or could be bona fide refugees, people that are fleeing persecution or violence in their home countries and could have a right to remain in the United States indefinitely. So the idea that we could just deport all of these kids and their families and the adults is not legal. And nor is it probably a remotely humane situation.
So we're also joined right now by Chris Hooks over the phone. He's our politics writer. He's in Dallas right now. And Chris, I wanted to ask you about Wendy Davis, her proposal this week. It was a letter to Governor Perry, and she was calling for a special session of the legislature. And I believe she also was calling on the governor to declare a state of emergency on the border.
There were four elements to her, okay. Her letter, and those were two of them, yeah.
So, you know, and the response from, let's say, Davis's Democratic base has been mixed to her ideas. Chris, what do you think is going on with her proposal?
Yeah, it's peculiar, the letter that she sent Perry, for a couple of reasons. In terms of policy, it's interesting that she's kind of calling in this letter for what some of the further right people were calling for about 2 weeks ago. You know, the first people to start talking about a special session on this were people like State Rep. Jonathan Stickland, people who are kind of generally not people who feel the same way that Wendy Davis does or her base does about immigration issues. And I think a lot of people were kind of surprised that she would call for a special session because, considering the mood that the legislature is in right now, especially in an election season and after some of the rhetoric we've seen from those guys, the idea that they would be in the mood to work towards some kind of a solution, like an actual practical solution on this, seems kind of unlikely. And given that a lot of people are looking for the next legislative session and are already kind of concerned about the bills that the legislature might pass on immigration, giving them kind of an excuse to confront these issues head on seemed like a kind of a curious proposal.
Especially since her experience with special sessions has not been necessarily a great one. In terms of the policy making that was going on.
He went there.
And the other thing that was that upset some immigrant advocates that was in her letter was a call for more federal judges. You know, at one level that makes sense because these dockets are super backed up, and what's happening is that a lot of these kids are basically released and then expected to show up for a court date that's in the distant future, and frankly, many people do not. The problem is that in immigration courts, you have no right to an attorney, and when you're dealing with kids, especially in a very complex area of the law, basically you can make an argument that getting more federal judges down there and expediting the process is basically putting these kids on the fast track for removal or deportation. Now, I haven't seen this reported anywhere else, but she also sent a letter to President Obama at the same time she sent this letter to Rick Perry that's been circulating. And in the letters were nearly the same, except the one difference that I saw was in the letter to Obama, She said, in addition to extra federal judges, I would like to see guardians ad litem for these kids. Basically, an adult to work with the child in the court to provide representation of some sort. And why that didn't make it into the Rick Perry letter and why the Davis campaign didn't make sure that folks who care about what happens to these kids saw that is a question that hasn't been answered yet. I asked them for comment today and haven't heard back as of the time we're recording this.
What about the response to her ideas from folks who would have been Davis supporters and maybe folks that she was going to be counting on to get out the vote and drum up more support locally? I mean, I know there's the famous Facebook bomb that some activists, used to get attention on her Facebook page. Is this going to end up hurting her election chances?
I mean, probably ultimately it's not a huge deal, but it's sort of one of these things where it's kind of a head scratcher because basically, what it comes down to is she says, yes, I agree with what Rick Perry and the Republicans want to do, which is send a bunch of DPS troopers down to the border to try to fight, the cartels and terrorists or whatever. And then making this inexplicable call for a special session and not putting much emphasis on how to address this problem of the suffering of these kids that are making this journey, or coming up with some like inventive ways to address the problem. So it's just another kind of head scratcher, I think, from the campaign. I do know that the Facebook bomb that some of the activists launched, last thing I saw is that her campaign did reach out to those folks and say, we want to listen. Here's the letter that we sent Obama. Notice that we do call for these kids to have some legal representation. And so I think that it got their attention, which is how this is supposed to work. And we'll see what happens next. Will she come out and have a different position in the next couple of days?
So the other thing I'm wondering is that, I mean, whether it's Jonathan Stickland or Rick Perry, who's going to be doing something about this at the state capitol. I mean, what role does Texas even have to play here? If we're talking about international treaties or, some of the solutions, when Melissa wrote a story about some of these issues a while back, she, had some maybe smarter solutions, and they were all things that were maybe about cooperation between the U.S. and Mexico and maybe finding ways to not lose track of people who get sent back and forth. Is there anything that a Texas politician should be trying to do here?
Well, I mean, I guess the most concrete thing that Texas is doing is spending an extra, I think, $1.3 million a week on DPS officers being sent to the border. The thing about that is that you can make a case for why that might make sense, but DPS officers are law enforcement officials at the state level. They have nothing to do with border enforcement. What they're doing is they're enforcing state law near the border. They're not border patrol. They're not, as far as I know, providing direct assistance to the border patrol in dealing with these kids. They're just filling the gap that is allegedly being left by the border patrol having to take care of all these unaccompanied minors crossing the border. So that's the most concrete thing. Ultimately, I think you get into a political space here where Rick Perry and Wendy Davis and others are basically Obama do something, the federal government's failing. And this is just a theme that has now come to dominate so much of our rhetoric and our discourse. Ultimately, it does beg for a national solution. This is a national border. This is a federal law that we're dealing with. It's an international situation. So insofar as Perry or anybody else says the feds need to do something about it, I think that's true. But what Texas can really do, it's probably limited. I do think that the risk is that going into the session starting in January, that this climate can lead to legislation being filed or even passed that may only be tangentially related, but could be very actively sort of aggressive on border security, very aggressive toward undocumented immigrants, and stands a better chance of passing possibly than previous sessions.
And that's really, I mean, lately that has not been something the legislature has been too fixated on in the last session or two. Yeah.
No, and that's been the interesting thing about Texas, versus, say, like in Arizona or in Alabama, where There have been a number of moderate and conservative Republicans in the business community that basically is happy with the status quo and doesn't want to go do a SB 1070, you know, show me your papers type thing, or going after sanctuary cities. But the political situation is going to be different in the legislature. And you also have this kind of mounting hysteria around what's happening at the border. Kids are going to bring diseases and cause a public health crisis. There's terrorists coming in while the Border Patrol is babysitting, yada, yada, yada. That type of climate is not usually good for, like, smart lawmaking.
What you have is a lot of kind of anger and frustration and resentment that are building up and don't really have anywhere to go right now, and probably won't have anywhere to go as far as being applied to actual policy solutions for a while. So it's definitely one thing that you've seen is people have kind of characterized the political divide on this issue in Texas as the Democrats want to do something about the humanitarian crisis, and conservatives, Republicans, want to do something about the security crisis, and saying that kind of both of these are legitimate and both need to be part of what the legislature ultimately does. But the problem with that, of course, is that some of the policy solutions that would be applied to those two problems are mutually exclusive. And you have people, Dan Patrick has kind of been ambiguous about this, or at least more ambiguous than you might think he would be, but the people that kind of constitute his base have been saying, you know, if you provide any comfort to these kids, people coming across the border, if you do anything to help them, if you do really anything but immediately deport them, then you're contributing to the problem. And that's something that can be easily applied to kind of only tangentially related policy measures that might be pushed.
Well, and Jonathan Stickland, I think, for example, he said we need to take the magnets away, all the special perks and privileges that immigrants get when they come here, and that's why they're coming here. Actually, the one of the tragedies of the situation is it is true that these folks, these kids in many cases, are misinformed about their prospects about staying in the United States. I think part of what's happened is DACA, which is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which was an executive order done by the Obama administration to deal with Dreamers, young people who came here when they were young, and can now apply for a permit, a temporary permit that cancels their deportation for a couple of years. That does not apply to these kids showing up today or yesterday or tomorrow, but things got distorted in Central America, and people have been led to believe that if they come here, that there's some sort of quote unquote, you know, amnesty, I guess is the term that the Tea Party would use, but the Obama administration is not responsible for misinformation circulating in Central America.
Well, thanks, guys. And Chris, thanks for joining us over the phone.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
All right.
Thanks.
So that's it for this week. But before we go, thanks to Rosie and the Ramblers for the music leading us in and out of the show. And thanks to all you listeners for your rapt attention. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schultz. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org. Subscribe to the Texas Observer or pick up the latest copy at a store near you. And join us next week for another half hour of Observer Radio.